From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, looking at the long-term needs of Somalia, we talk with the president of CARE, Philip Johnston, about his organization's efforts to help the people of Somalia rebuild their farms and their economy. Also, novelist Robert Boswell tells us about his latest book, Mystery Ride, about the enduring quality of a failed marriage. Rock historian Ed Ward takes us back to the year 1963, and commentator Maureen Carrigan reviews Homestead, about the town that was once the center of America's steel industry. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. At the United Nations, Britain and France are reported to have come up with a resolution aimed at diffusing the controversy over the Palestinians expelled by Israel to southern Lebanon. The proposed resolution would stress the need for all of the Palestinians to be allowed to return, but the resolution would stop short of Arab demands for sanctions against Israel. The BBC's John Lyne reports.
The calculation is that as a result of Israel's decision to return home around 100 of the Palestinians, there are no longer enough votes on the Security Council to pass a resolution imposing sanctions. Resolutions need the positive votes of 9 council members. According to some diplomats, only 4 or 5 members of the council would now be willing to vote for sanctions. So a sanctions resolution could fall without the United States having to use its veto. What Britain and France are hoping is that the non-aligned countries would rather support the compromise resolution being drafted than see the idea of sanctions defeated in such a humiliating way. Although the United States would prefer the issue not to come before the Security Council at all, the Anglo-French compromise would have the benefit for Washington of improving the atmosphere for the resumption of the Middle East peace talks.
John Lyne at the United Nations. Democrats in Congress are moving closer to passing a family leave bill. In the House, they overcame Republican opposition to new rules that allow the delegates from the District of Columbia and U.S. territories to vote. The family leave measure is expected to go to a vote in the House by the end of the day. An almost identical bill moved more slowly in the Senate, where Republicans made repeated attempts to amend it. In Los Angeles, jury selection began today in the federal trial of the 4 Los Angeles police officers accused of beating Rodney King. The federal government has charged that the officers intended to beat King more than was necessary to take him into custody and thus violated his constitutional rights. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
Some 350 jurors, about 10% of whom were African American, assembled in court this morning and were given a lengthy questionnaire containing 148 separate questions. Jurors were asked about the not guilty verdicts reached in the first trial in state court. They were asked about the riots that followed and about race. The questionnaires will be reviewed by the attorneys for the government and for the defense, and next week they will return to court to begin the process of eliminating jurors based on their written answers. Oral questioning of the remaining jurors will begin in 2 weeks. Defense attorneys are plainly concerned about the willingness of jurors to base their verdict solely on the evidence without worrying about the possibility of another riot. Jurors selected for this trial will be sequestered and will remain anonymous. At the federal courthouse in Los Angeles, this is Wendy Kaufman reporting.
Stock prices surged today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials gained more than 45 points to close at 3,374. This is NPR. The White House has refused to declare support for the Bosnian peace plan negotiated by mediators for the United Nations and the European Community. Spokesman George Stephanopoulos said that President Clinton is waiting for an internal policy review to be completed before he announces a policy toward the former Yugoslavia. Stephanopoulos said the president neither supports nor rejects the plan, which would divide Bosnia and Herzegovina into 10 semi-autonomous provinces. A French relief group is calling for an end to the fighting among the warring factions in Kabul. The group says the situation in the Afghan capital has become desperate. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
The French relief group, Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, said about 1,000 people have died and more than 3,000 have been injured in fighting during the past 15 days between the government and opposition parties. MSF said that blind artillery and mortar attacks have intensified since Monday. The group said the center and southern part of the capital have been devastated. Said it's performed 30 major operations in the past few days, and that more than 100 people have been admitted to emergency care. MSF is the only relief group, along with the International Committee of the Red Cross, which is operating in Kabul. Most diplomats have left. MSF said it needs medication and that hospitals lack electricity and heating. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
UN relief officials say the civil war in Angola could put as many as 2 million people in danger of starvation. In places where the growing season has been good, the continued fighting has prevented many farmers from harvesting their crops or moving their produce to market. The government also prohibits UN relief workers from operating freely in the areas controlled by the UNITA rebel faction. Many of the places where relief workers can go have already been hit by a severe drought. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowain. U.S. troops were sent to Somalia last year to aid humanitarian efforts to feed thousands of Somalis threatened with starvation and to restore order in that war-torn country. These U.S. troops are beginning to be sent home as the United Nations takes over operations in that country. Dr. Philip Johnson is the director of the relief organization CARE. Last fall, he was appointed by the U.N. to coordinate humanitarian assistance to Somalia. He just returned to the States from Mogadishu, where he has been working for the last few months, and reports that most of the food, medicine, and supplies are getting to the people. His next project is to think about the Somalia of the future. He's currently designing and implementing a rehabilitation plan for the country. Tomorrow, he will report to the United Nations about the current situation and about his plans to rebuild Somalia's economy.
The conditions today compared to the conditions before the troops arrived is hugely different. It was one very exasperating and frustrating and whatever experience before, when so many people were dying as a result of food which we could not get to them, but we had the food in the harbor. From a psychological point of view, it was very difficult to be a humanitarian in Somalia in those days. Now, in comparison, food is being delivered to those that are hungry, and medicine is being delivered to those that are sick. Seed and tools, for example, are being delivered unimpeded to farmers, and the humanitarian program is functioning much, much better, and many more Somalis are alive today than would have been alive if those troops had not arrived.
Do you still need soldiers to ensure that food and medicine and seeds arrive safely?
Yes, I'm sorry to say that we do, because there are a percentage of the Somali society that are still marauders and thugs and bandits, and they would clearly try to intervene, stealing the food or the medicine or whatever the supplies were for their own benefit, denying it to those people who are on the edge of survival. But as you know, the U.S. is about to downsize its military commitment, and the U.N. is going to take over the management of the military unit. The U.N. is going to expand the military presence from the Kenyan border all the way up to the Djibouti border, so it will be a much wider geographical area that they oversee than is presently the case for the United States forces.
The United Nations is not warmly looked upon in Somalia. General Mohamed Aid threatened warfare if the UN takes over the U.S. operations, and he expressed concern that Somalia would become a UN trusteeship. Why this attitude towards the United Nations in Somalia?
Well, because the United Nations is in the process of political reconciliation. The U.S. has stayed at arm's length from that process. General Adid, as well as the interim president Ali Mahdi and 14 other fractional leaders, are engaged in the political reconciliation process, in which they are vying for who is going to be dominant in Somalia at the end of the political reconciliation process. And this is central to where some of these people are going to end up. The U.S. is not engaged in the political reconciliation. That is purely a U.N. function. And in trying to work that a political settlement out, a lot of hackles are raised.
How important is it that Somalis rebuild their country, whether it's politically or economically or educationally?
Well, I personally believe it's central to the whole thing. We are engaged in an exercise to help Somalis restore hope to that nation, and part of that restoration process is a belief that they can be in charge of their own country, that they can solve their own problems, that they can be engaged in the solution. And in that process, Somalis come to grips with what Somalis have done to and for Somalis. I mean, they engineered the destruction of their own country. Unwittedly, Somalis visited this upon Somalis. And coincidentally, they must be a part of the process of righting their own ship.
Do you have concerns that relief can create a kind of dependency? And in terms of Somalia making the steps to become a country again, that as much as relief has kept the country alive, it also can keep it dependent?
Well, that is certainly true in the food arena. I'm not so sure about other disciplines, but in the food area, that is clearly true. And we must be very careful to ensure that Somali farmers have a Somali market for their crops, and if there are export crops, that they be promoted and compete on the world market. But it is essential that Somali farmers not be disadvantaged as a result of the free food that is being brought in. To ensure that that does not happen, we have set in motion a process to monitor the nutritional status of children in Somalia, and we have put in place a process of crop assessment so we know how much is being grown, where it is being grown, and how much might the harvest be. And then we are asking governments for money to buy food produced by Somalis that can be delivered to areas of scarcity in Somalia.
My guest is Dr. Philip Johnson. He's the president of CARE, the Relief and Development Organization. He was appointed last fall by the United Nations to coordinate humanitarian assistance to Somalia, and he's currently working on plans to rebuild the country's economy. How do you deal with the displacement, the fact that so many people left where they were living to go to parts of Somalia where they could find food? Do you want these people then to return to their villages, to their farms?
Yes. We have a program for the return of internally displaced, and we have a different program for the return of refugees that have sought asylum outside the country, particularly in Kenya and in Ethiopia. But for the bulk of those, it is a rather straightforward process. However, there are elements of the displaced and the refugees that are more difficult to see what the resolution of their particular problem is going to be. That specifically is in reference to women who have lost their husbands and cannot go back and claim their ancestral farm or whatever it is. And secondly, the orphans, the children who are now orphaned without parents and are living in large numbers in clusters in and around Mogadishu and other cities. We are going to have to deal with the bulk of the people first and these special cases later. But they are clearly a part of the overall problem which Somalia confronts one with.
Well, I want to talk about all those people, but let me first, let's talk about people that are able to return to their villages. Are you suggesting that they be put on trucks and be taken back to where they were, or how do you suggest they go home?
Well, if they are able to tell whatever organization they are working with, exactly where they are from, then getting them back to wherever that point is a mechanical process. usually by the provision of transportation. But it is not sufficient to just give them transportation back. One has to make sure they have food to eat when they arrive and until they can grow their own crops. They have to have water to drink, or there has to be water available for the expanded number of people who are drawing water from whatever well it is in their area. They have to have tools to use if they are farmers, or they have to have herds or animals if they are pastoralists to deal with, because if they're from the nomadic community, they won't go back if they do not have animals on which they can depend. So one has to create the circumstances for their viability.
You mentioned the women that have lost their husbands and the orphans that have lost their parents. Do you really need to build new institutions within the society to deal with this situation?
Well, as far as orphans go, if we can find where the child comes from, it is possible that the joint family can absorb the child or children into the larger family if there's an uncle that is alive, if there is a family unit of grandparents that can take the child in or children in. But one has to do that kind of work on a case-by-case basis.
So the country really doesn't have orphanages or places where unmarried women can live and raise their children?
There are a very limited number of orphanages, and unprotected women in Somali society that's a real challenge.
Because?
Because their society doesn't deal well with women who are on their own. It is a very traditionalist society, and unprotected women have a difficult time in their society, for example, getting by economically.
How much does Somalia need new roads, need new schools, need new hospitals in terms of infrastructure? Is there anything left?
Well, there's very little left. I must say, to the credit of the United States Engineering Corps, most of the main five major arteries have been rebuilt in southern and central Somalia. We are hauling food over roads that before they arrived were not passable. So all credit is due to the engineering corps that has done that work. In terms of physical structure, hospitals and schools and other, most of those have been totally destroyed. And there is a large rebuilding process ahead of us.
How long do you see this rebuilding of Somalia taking?
Well, it depends upon what it is that's to be rebuilt. There are certain things that have higher priority than others. For example, it is more important to the population that health clinics be developed as different from hospitals. It is more important that preventative health capability be developed than curative health capability. The Somalis have told us that elementary school education is more important to reestablish than secondary school education. So we have a $7 million program for the reestablishment of elementary school education grades 1 through 8 in every district of the country as part of the 93 rehabilitation plan.
Are there any bright spots in Somalia?
Absolutely, all over the place. We have reestablished the agricultural sector. We are in the process of harvesting food right at the moment. We have begun the reestablishment of the veterinary services, and we have begun the reestablishment of the primary school program, and we have begun the reestablishment of the health infrastructure. And I must tell you with great joy that just at the end of last week, we succeeded in getting the Mogadishu auxiliary security force put back in place, which hopefully will be the precursor of the police force in Mogadishu. So there is tangible progress, and that tangible progress is important for Somalis to see because it is evidence to them and for them that progress is and can be made.
Well, I thank you very much, Dr. Johnson, for your time today.
You're most welcome, Marty. Thank you.
Dr. Philip Johnson is the president of CARE. He's designing a plan to rebuild Somalia's economy, which he will present tomorrow to the United Nations. Next, Ed Ward helps us remember 1963. This is Fresh Air. For a few minutes, rock historian Ed Ward wants us to remember the year 1963. It's been 10 years since Elvis ushered in the rock and roll revolution, but it's taking America a while to catch on to the newest musical phenomena.
That's easy. That was the year of the Beatles, right? Well, actually, no. At least not in America. That May, the Fab Four ended the longtime ping-pong game for number one on the British charts between Cliff Richards and the Shadows by putting From Me to You at the top for nearly 2 months. But the news that a group was big in England was hardly something that Capitol Records, who had first refusal on the Beatles' records, was going to get too excited about. In fact, while the Beatles were conquering England, here's the record that was at the top of the American pop and R&B charts. It's my party and I'll cry if I want to, cry if I want to, cry if I want to. You would cry too if it happened to you. Nobody knows where my Johnny has gone. Maybe it takes a blast of a song like that to remind us today of what a dark age the British invasion delivered us from. You want some more examples? The year started with Go Away Little Girl by Steve Lawrence at the top, and other number ones included Hey Paula by Paul and Paula, which was also a top R&B hit, Sukiyaki by Kiyo Sakamoto, Blue Velvet by Bobby Vinton, Deep Purple by Nino Tempo and April Stevens, and Dominique by The Singing Nun. Trash, all of it. But then, pop music's always been about trash. There was good trash, too. My boyfriend's back and you're gonna be in trouble. Hey la, hey la, my boyfriend's back. When you see him coming, better cut out on the double. Hey la, hey la, my boyfriend's back. You've been spreading lies that I was untrue. Hey la, hey la, my boyfriend's back. So look out now, cause he's coming after you. The factory system of American pop music, commonly known as Brill Building Pop, after the building on Broadway's Tin Pan Alley where much of it was made, was having the start of its last great period in 1963. Executives like Don Kirshner of Dimension Records hired songwriters like Carole King and Jerry Goffin, Jeff Barry and Ellie Greenwich, and sometimes the results could be wonderful. Nor were all of these so-called girl groups based in New York, even though the Brill Building did dominate the scene in 1963. One of the spookiest records of the year came from Chicago. Sally, go round the roses. Sally, go round the pretty roses. Roses, they can't hurt you. Roses, they can't hurt you.
Even in the dullest times, records like the Jeanettes' Sally Go Round the Roses sneak through. In fact, if one blanket statement could be said to characterize the malaise that was 1963, it would be that the airwaves were dominated by factory-made pop, with occasional relief coming from the Brill Building or from odd regional records, like this one by Dale and Grace from Ville Platte, Louisiana.
I'm leaving it all up to you. You decide what you're gonna do.
Or this one, from a city whose music scene was really more famous for jazz.
I don't like you, but I love you. Seems that I'm always thinking of you, though you treat me badly. I love you, madly. You really got a hold on me.
Really got a hold on me.
Smokey Robinson and the Miracles recorded for Berry Gordy, Jr., who had had a lot of trouble launching his Tamla Motown family of labels, but by 1963, it was beginning to pay off. The base of his talent pool was coming together, with Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, Mary Wells, the so far hitless Supremes and Temptations, and an odd little blind kid named Steveland Morris. The only other regional scene, and it was a big one, was in California, but not in Hollywood. No, a little further west, like on the beach.
If everybody had an ocean across the USA, then everybody'd be surfing like California. You'd see them wearing their baggies, Huarache sandals too. Bushy, bushy blonde hairdo, surfing USA. You'll catch them surfing at the
inside, outside USA.
Ventura County line.
Then, in November, the president was shot, and the nation was so anesthetized that it could only hear the Singing Nun and Dominique. But with the coming of a new year, a new sound would conquer the world, and things would never be the same again.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Oh yeah, I tell you something, I think you'll understand. When I say that something, I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. Oh please, say to me, let me be your man.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowain with Fresh Air. Coming up, a talk about families, writing, and the inexhaustible mystery of love with novelist Robert Boswell. His latest book is Mystery Ride, about the enduring quality of a failed marriage. Boswell's the author of two other acclaimed novels, Crooked Hearts and The Geography of Desire. And commentator Maureen Carrigan reviews Homestead, about the decline of Homestead, Pennsylvania, once America's greatest steel center. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Officials at the State Department have indicated some confidence today that Arab-Israeli peace talks can be resumed, despite continuing Arab anger over Israel's expulsion of 400 Palestinians. Those expelled were allegedly affiliated with extremist groups. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Israel's decision Monday to allow one-fourth of the deportees to return was rejected as inadequate by Palestinian and other Arab leaders. Some are calling on the United Nations to impose sanctions on Israel. Some threaten to boycott future peace talks. But State Department spokesman Richard Boucher indicated that the deportation controversy is surmountable. He said today the U.S. has been consulting with Arab governments, with Palestinians, and with many others around the world.
In our exchanges, generally, I'd say that we're finding broad acknowledgement of the importance of avoiding counterproductive confrontations at the United Nations and of the need to advance the Middle East peace talks.
Boucher said the U.S. expects to have a decision, quote, fairly soon on a date for the next round of talks. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
According to the White House, President Clinton may lift a ban imposed by President Reagan on hiring back fired air traffic controllers. A spokeswoman at the White House says that Mr. Clinton believes that the ban on air traffic controllers set the tone for government-labor relations during the 1980s. While the president is said not to have made a final decision on the matter, he is said to be committed to changing that labor-government relationship. The ban was imposed after air traffic controllers went out on strike in violation of federal law. A Federal Trade Panel report on the proposed North American Free Trade Agreement says that agreement will provide a slight benefit to the U.S., but will be far more beneficial to Mexico. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The study requested by Congress and obtained by NPR was written by the International Trade Commission, an independent federal agency. It says the impact of the North America Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, will be felt in the Midwest, the South, and the West. Industries likely to benefit from NAFTA are machine tools, bearings, industrial machinery, steel mill products, pharmaceuticals, textiles, grains, cotton, wood products, and automotive parts. Losers could be automobiles, apparel, flat glass, major household appliances, shrimp, peanuts, certain fresh and frozen vegetables, citrus fruit, and fresh-cut roses. The ITC report says long-term employment gains will be less than 1% for the U.S. and Canada, but almost 7% for Mexico. The ITC report is likely to be widely quoted in the upcoming debate over the trade agreement. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 45 points to close at 3,373.79 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. On Capitol Hill, both the House and Senate at this hour are considering a family leave bill, and a vote in the House is expected sometime later tonight. But debate is moving slowly in both houses. This afternoon, Republicans tried to prevent a new House rule from taking effect, which gives a partial right to vote to delegates from the District of Columbia and U.S. territories. That effort was defeated. Secretary of Health and Human Services Donna Shalala made her first official appearance on Capitol Hill today. She testified in favor of legislation that would create a battery of new programs at the National Institutes of Health. NPR's Joe Palca has a report.
President Bush vetoed the NIH legislation last year because it would have ended the ban on federal funding for some fetal research. Congressional leaders put the bill on a fast track this year. At today's hearing before the House Subcommittee on Health and the Environment, Shalala said the Clinton administration supported the bill, especially new programs for the health of women and minorities. She said the administration would strongly support basic research that seeks to explain how the human body functions.
We have to invest more in basic research in order to provide the foundation for future biomedical research and to make significant progress in the discovery of cures and treatments for diseases.
She vowed that commitment will be reflected in President Clinton's budget that will be delivered to Congress next month. I'm Joe Palca in Washington.
UN officials say that a large UN peacekeeping force is needed in Somalia to take over U.S.-led operations there. There are now some 38,000 troops in the nation, about 20,000 of them Americans. While some order has been restored in the country and aid is moving again, there are continued clashes between rival factions, and a huge supply of hidden arms were found overnight in the capital of Somalia. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Families have been at the center of writer Robert Boswell's fiction. His stories have been about the complexities and nuances of family life. Crooked Hearts, written in 1987, is about a family torn apart by internal conflicts. The book established Boswell as an important new writer. New York Times critic Michiko Kakutani called it a dazzling debut. His new novel, Mystery Ride, follows the lives of Angela and Stephen Landis through their 6-year marriage, their divorce and new relationships, and explores the ties, including their daughter Dulcie, that keep them attached. Robert Boswell lives in New Mexico, where he teaches at New Mexico State University. He told me that the idea for this book came to him when he heard these words from a Bruce Springsteen song.
Would they ever look so happy again, the handsome groom and his bride, as they stepped into that long black limousine for their mystery ride?
Now, what was it about those lines that struck you?
Well, I had been working on the novel for about 3 years, and I was in my truck driving to Arizona from New Mexico and listening to the tape that I'd heard many times, and it struck me when I heard that particular passage of the song that my characters were on a mystery ride. And while this song was talking about a wedding, and my characters were now divorced, that while their marriage had ended, they were still on the mystery ride, that they were still in some way committed to each other in a very deep and profound way.
Well, what you really seem to be saying throughout this book, and as you write about the characters and things happen to them, is that married people really can't get divorced entirely. They can't entirely get divorced from each other.
Well, this couple certainly can't, and I think that's what I want to explore. It seems to me that there are a lot of couples like that.
Ones that you've observed, friends who have gotten divorced but can't get separated from each other?
Well, this particular couple, it seems to me, found, well, true love, found real deep, profound love. And that part of that love had to do with their sense of personal integrity. They found each found a double in the other. But I also feel it's that personal integrity, that desire to be true to some part of themselves, that ultimately pushes them apart because they each have to find some way to be true to that. So it seemed to me that what brought them together and what pushed them apart was the same thing.
Let me get you to read a section from the book, and this is rather early on, in which Angela is really describing, she's thinking about the marriage that she had to Stephen, and this kind of summarizes it.
They had stayed married only 6 years, but Stephen was the father of her daughter and the first man she had ever loved. There were moments when she longed for him. She had been 22 when she married him. They had known each other since she was a senior in high school, and their courtship had had the slowness of care. She had been dating Andrew, Stephen's younger brother, and although she had slept with Andrew on their second date, she did not sleep with Stephen for nearly 2 years, the weight, a delirious power that surged through them both. They married and were unreasonably happy for a time, then they were no longer happy and they divorced. Even now, Angela cannot say what had happened. She had seen a strength of character in Stephen that had been absent in other boys. For that matter, she had never seen that sort of strength in anyone else. She had known he would never leave her, would always love her, but she found she could not stay with him. He was a strong and serious man, but what good was it doing him? He had decided, randomly as far as she could tell, to become a farmer and to remain a farmer. That decision pointed the marriage toward failure. Life became restricted to the possibilities of a few cultivated acres of land, while the rest of the world slipped with increasing quickness beyond Angela's grasp.
Those couple of paragraphs really sum up the history of this marriage. And what you seem to be saying is that couples and individuals within a couple make a decision that has a kind of unintended or unanticipated effect on the other person. And that, at least in this marriage, there wasn't something horrible and huge that happened that drove them apart. It was a series of decisions made along the way, which in the end ended the marriage.
Yes, I think that novels very often focus on problems that explosive sorts of problems, and marriages break up because there is an affair or there's some dramatic moment that pushes people apart. And it seems to me that very often marriages break up because some unwritten agreement, some unspoken agreement even, changes. And one person may feel that the agreement still should be honored, while the other person is living under the assumption that they've gone past that, that they've gone beyond that. And I think that's very often the reason why marriages fail.
Do you think most couples have a kind of wordless contract? There's the out loud contract, and then there's the one that no one talks about.
Yeah, the one no one talks about is the one that really matters. All those unspoken agreements. I mean, everyone has some sense, some vision of how they want to spend his or her life. And when you get married, you have some sense of how you want to spend your lives together. And early on, there's an assumption that you see the world in the same way. But as you stay together, your vision not only changes, sometimes it's just a matter of your vision becomes clarified. And it's very rare, I think, that two people can continue to share the same vision for an extended period of time.
Well, I got the impression in reading your book that what you're saying about, certainly about this marriage and perhaps marriages in general, is that you really can't understand them as you live them. You can't understand them entirely as they're going on. They only make sense when you look back at them.
Yeah, I think you're lucky if they make sense then.
Or maybe they make more sense.
Yeah, they make more sense. I think that's true of most things, though. We don't really know what we're up to while we're in the middle of it. And we can't see any design until we can look back on it. I think, in fact, that's part of why people love novels, is that it gives you a perspective on life, that you can see these characters' lives and see how there's a certain sense and a certain order to their lives, and it at least suggests that perhaps there's also a certain sense in order to your own life.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we have to take a very short break, and my guest on Fresh Air is Robert Boswell. He's a novelist, and his newest novel is called Mystery Ride. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with writer Robert Boswell. Your father was a public school principal, is that right?
He was a principal of the elementary school in Wycliffe when we lived in Kentucky. And then when we moved to Arizona, he was a school teacher, first in a junior high and then in high school.
Was he ever your teacher or your principal?
He was my principal when I was in, let's see, first through fourth grade, the first half of fourth grade. But he was never my teacher by design. That is, he didn't want me in class, and I thought it would be sort of weird, too, so we avoided each other.
Well, when you passed your father in the hall, did you say, "Hi, Dad," or "Hi, Mr. Boswell"?
I said, "Hi, Dad," if I acknowledged him. I was, I think I was sort of a lousy kid, sort of a difficult kid in high school.
How do you mean that?
Well, I was in trouble a lot, and I was defiant, and while I was still very close to my family, I didn't always want to let anyone else know that, because I guess I thought that wasn't cool.
Well, so were you kind of like the minister's son, if you know what I mean? Which is the minister's son is the wildest kid in town?
Well, I tried to play both sides against the middle. That is, I was on student council and things like that in high school because I knew that that would play well with my father and his friends, all of whom taught at the high school. But then I had this other life where I was pretty rowdy and, of course, I couldn't keep one life separate from the other and wound up getting into some trouble. But it seemed to me, that's often the way I've lived, sort of tried to have these two lives. And at some point as an adult, I tried to determine which one was closest to who I really am and to pursue that one.
So do you still get in trouble as an adult?
Not so much, no.
You're better at getting away with it or better at choosing one life over the other?
Better at choosing one life over the other. I think what rebellion I have now exists more in my work and exploring rebellion in my work. I mean, Dulcie, the 15-year-old girl in this novel, is based a lot on my memory of what it was like to be 15, and I pursue that anger and the sort of, you know how you, when you're 15, there's a certain kind of buzz that you have. It's internal, and you feel you have to be true to it all the time, and if you aren't true to it, somehow you're selling out, and I wanted to explore that with this character, and I think my wildness is expressed through her.
Let me just switch gears here in the couple of minutes that we have left. You did work as a therapist for a while, as a rehab counselor before becoming a writer. Does that explain part of your interest in family life? And was being a counselor a way to understand families just the way writing is a way to understand families?
Yeah, my interest in psychology and in counseling, I think, stems from the same source as my interest in literature. I found that literature for me was a much more rewarding way to explore human behavior than psychology. I resist, really, psychology more and more, because it seems to me that that any kind of ideology, adherence to any kind of ideology, places real limitations on your ability to understand humans and understand the world. It seems to me that ideology is the light that creates the darkness, that it may shine a very specific light on a very specific instance, but then everything around it is dark, and I'm less and less a believer in psychology.
But did psychology help you love your characters as you seem to do, and you don't judge your characters, or they don't come off as if the writer who wrote them is judging them?
Well, I think I owe that more to reading Chekhov or reading Alice Munro or reading great literature, wherein people sometimes are doing terrible things, and Chekhov, for example, never judges them, never suggests that we should feel superior to them. So my allegiance is with literature. It really dawned on me when I was an undergraduate, and I have a split major in creative writing and psychology, and I had been studying Freud in a class, and then in a lit class I was reading Melville, and it seemed to me that Melville made a much more profound examination of the human experience than Freud, and I thought, time to jump ship.
And how easy was it to jump ship? It's not like you just become a writer the next day once you give up being a rehab counselor.
Well, it was hard. I had a place on the beach in San Diego, and I remember telling, and I was paid pretty well, and I remember telling my father that I was going to quit and go back to graduate school to study writing, that I wanted to be a writer. And he said, well, if that's what you want to do, you should pursue it. And then he said, but you're going to miss that money. And then...
Have you?
Well, no, I never did. I never did. I was broke for a while, for a pretty long while, but I knew pretty quickly that I had to give myself a chance to be a writer.
Robert Boswell's newest novel is called Mystery Ride. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer joins us to tell us about the news today. Linda, what stories will you be covering on All Things Considered?
The lead story today, Marty, is the Los Angeles Police Department trial starts again, this time on federal civil rights charges. Jury selection began today. We'll have a report from Capitol Hill on the Republicans and gays in the military, what they're going to do. President Clinton went today to the Office of Management and Budget to discuss whether or not the White House budget can be cut. We have a feature on going to school in Sarajevo in the midst of the siege, and old cheese, 200-year-old cheese, auctioned in London.
Okay, Linda, those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Everyone from Washington to Wall Street to small towns across the country are trying to figure out how to improve our economy. Commentator Maureen Corrigan has a review of a new book entitled Homestead by William Saron. She says it should be required reading for anyone who wants to understand how things got so bad.
In his introduction to Homestead, William Saron says, "I wrote this book because I came to understand that if I did not, no one would." That's a pretty audacious claim to make in this era of publishing glut, when everybody from Norman Schwarzkopf to David Bowie's ex-wife gets to tell his or her life story, and when even the history of corn makes the must-read lists. What kind of story doesn't get told these days? Well, try selling stories about dying steel mills and the workers who spent their lives in them. Saron is right. Tales of contemporary blue-collar workers don't much appeal to a largely white-collar audience. Probably no one else would have bothered to write this book about a Pennsylvania town called Homestead that for most of this century was America's greatest steel center. And for sure, no one else could have matched the impassioned eloquence of Saron. He manages to weave in details about the rise of the Steelworkers Union, explanations of how steel is made, and portraits of ordinary citizens as well as captains of industry like Andrew Carnegie. Saron has written an epic of American labor history that deeply respects but doesn't lazily romanticize workers or unions. Danny DeVito should have taken a tutorial from Saron before he made that bore of a hagiography called Hoffa. Saron's sweeping narrative begins in 1883 when Carnegie bought the Homestead Steelworks and turned it into a sprawling empire. Shortly after, the modern American labor movement was born at Homestead during the bloody strike of 1892. Steelworkers, their wives, and children occupied the works and the town and fought armed Pinkerton detectives as well as the Pennsylvania militia. Never before had American workers risen up in such numbers and with such desperation, but they lost. And it wasn't until 1936 that the Homestead Works were finally unionized. Seren takes us through the boom years of the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. Then the industry began downsizing. By the mid-1980s, a depression far worse than the Great Depression had hit the steel industry. More than 150,000 workers had been laid off, 40% of the industry's workforce. Remember, this is during the 1980s, the decade when all of us supposedly got rich. As he describes the struggles of the unemployed steelworkers, Seren himself struggles with a nostalgia for the working class culture that's been decimated and a sober recognition that the lost jobs were often brutal and soul-destroying. But where are the well-paying alternatives? One steelworker Seren talks to explains that, "We came a long way. We were, how would you say it, people nobody thought much of, and we became halfway decent people, almost middle-class people." He pauses, and then he says, "They don't want you to be middle-class." Seren has to turn aside at this point because the steelworker is crying. Nobody Seren talks to has a solution to this ongoing economic disaster. But it's early days yet. Let's hope Bill Clinton thinks of something.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Fresh Air was produced today by Fred Landrell. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, and Richard Parker. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Marty Moscowain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, probing the Dietrich mystique, we talk with the daughter of actress Marlena Dietrich, Maria Riva. She's written a memoir about her mother that relies on Dietrich's diaries and love letters. I'm Marty Moscowain, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.